At the end of October, Reformed churches across the world will be marking the 500 years since the Reformation. The story of the Reformation began on the 31st of October 1517 with the monk Martin Luther nailing his 95 theses proclaiming the failings of the Roman Church to a church door in Wittenberg. While there may not be historical proof of the event, it was to kick-start the Reformation of church and faith life across Europe. The events in Scotland may have begun some years later, but here in this building we are witness to the transformation that Reformation caused to both buildings and people. Our newer addition to an ancient building reveals the continuing journey of faith, of the painful leaving of a well-known comfortable past to walk into a new way of being God's people. Sometimes during the summer, I hover around the building while there are tourists visiting, partly as a result of being here on a Wednesday for prayers, partly as a transition from visits to meetings, sometimes just to fix the hospitality loom. In these moments, I enjoy hearing the story of the building and its history being retold by our custodians to those who are visiting. Sometimes I get caught unawares, because people ask me. A common theme that returns when chatting with others about the significant change that the Reformation brought to this building is the thought that it was a shame that so much damage was done to what would have been a spectacular and significant building in Scotland. We can only imagine that the stone beauty of the nave would have been replicated and embellished within this section on which our church stands. Perhaps if we close our eyes, we can imagine what this holiest of holy parts would have looked like. We know from the recent radar survey of some parts of the building that the pillars of the current church are placed upon the foundations of the original pillars, and that knowledge really does allow us to use our imagination because it gives us a shape for the chancel and the aisles that would have swept around it. If you look towards the pillars, they may well have been carved and finely decorated like those closest to the rood screen in the nave. They would have towered into a vaulted ceiling that would either have been decorated with stone bosses or beautifully painted to replicate the heavens. Between the pillars would have been a screen forming an inner chancel surrounded by the north and south transepts, leading to the side aisles that shape the apse, where St. Margaret's shrine would have been a focal point. The pews in the centre of our church sit on top of where the chancel space would have been, and a low altar probably just about where the elders' chairs sit, and then a high altar at the feet of Bruce's memorial plaque. And while we might mourn the travesty of the destruction of the Reformation, we should also recognise that even without the Reformation, we still might not have seen this holiest of places that no longer exists. Because for ordinary people, those who were not priests or abbots or bishops or kings or queens, this holy place was hidden by a large screen across the entrance. This was not for the ordinary, but only for those who were set apart for divine purpose. Is it a shame that it's gone, or a wonder that we now sit in the holiest of holy places? We don't know what alternative history may have offered without a Reformation. But given the need for conflict and destruction within the human mindset, we can only imagine that elements of the original beauty of this building would still have been lost to time. That story of this congregation's journey to a new life in a different world has a resonance with the story we hear from Exodus this morning. Although I suspect that those of a certain age have been caught up in visions of Charlton Heston standing between towering walls of water in a Cecil B. DeMille film. But beyond those film images, many will struggle with the God of the Exodus, because it tells the story of a God prepared to harm one group of people to ensure the safe passage of another to a different life. It's not the story of a loving God we value and around whom we shape our lives. How might we reconcile ourselves to an understanding of this story, and how might it inform our lives? Are we to live with a God who allows human suffering and even seems to be involved in it? Or is there a truth to be revealed that will shape our lives today? That passage from Exodus is the final moment of the flight from Egypt after plagues of blood, frogs, gnats, flies, on livestock, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and then on the firstborn. We have to remember as we read the story that it will have been written down centuries after the event and written in such a way to reveal the people of Israel as the people of God. It's one of the stories that shapes their journey to worship in the temple. In 2010, the National Geographic Channel aired a programme that offered a scientific perspective on the plagues of Egypt and challenged the view of a vengeful God, keen to separate the chosen people from an oppressor. The programme suggested that scientific evidence suggested a rise in temperature in the area around Egypt during the reign of Ramesses. These temperatures would have dried up the Nile, offering the perfect habitat for a toxic water algae that would have then looked like blood. And that algae would have set in motion the perfect conditions for frogs, lice and flies. As water became slower moving and toxic, the stress on tadpoles would have sped up their transformation to frogs and forced them out of the water, where they would have then died, and without a natural predator, insects would have thrived. These parasites would have then aided in the plague on livestock and of boils. Around the same time, another natural disaster of an earthquake is thought to be the trigger of the plagues of hail, locusts and darkness. The final plague of the death of the firstborn may have been caused by a fungus that poisoned the grain supply, which the firstborn male would have had first pickings. The Israelites remain unaffected by that plague because they do not live amongst the Egyptians. Instead, they live in Goshen. As slaves, they're much further down the food chain and less likely to receive the grain growing for Egyptian consumption. Whether these scientific theories be true, they do offer an opportunity to unpick faith story from history and recognise the hope of redemption from the burden of the people and things that enslave us, to move into new uncharted territory reliant on God. Our story this morning may tell of miraculous message out of an old way of living through water's creations, a miraculous passage that travels. We move through creation's waters because that's what we're supposed to hear when we hear the water separating. We return to Genesis and to the moment of creation. And as we journey through that creation, we're led to a new Eden. But if you know Exodus, you know that within two chapters, we will find that the people of Israel moan that they would have been better off back in Egypt. How might we hear this story alongside Peter and Jesus' conversation in the Gospel of Matthew? Is there forgiveness within what we heard from the Old Testament, or are the stories contradictory? The gospel story is certainly not about maths, but it's about limitless forgiveness. Peter thinks he's being generous when he says, "Should I forgive seven times?" He thinks that's a generous number. Three times is rabbinical custom. He's giving an extra four. And he uses a perfect number to suggest that God might be within that seven times forgiveness, a suggestion of a completion of the act of God. So he must have been astounded to be challenged to go beyond his expectation, whether it be 70 times 7, as our translation suggests, or 7 times 70, as the literal translation of the Greek suggests. Jesus' expectation suggests only continual forgiveness can build communities and relationships. When we recognise the immensity of the forgiveness of debt in the figures offered within the parable that Jesus tells, perhaps we begin to recognise the extent to which we are to be challenged in our offering of forgiveness. Perhaps we might recognise the depth of the debt to which we are being asked to move to. A talent represented £130 of silver, which would take a labourer 15 years to earn. So the first servant owes the master 150,000 years of labour. Meanwhile, a denarius was a day's wage. So the second servant owes the first servant 100 days' wages. It's still a big debt, but it's not insurmountable. It's not helpful to put ourselves in the place of any of the characters in the story. And we're not meant to. Instead, we are to recognise the immense opportunity for forgiveness. In a commentary on the text, Chris Gorsey writes, "The social animosity that comes from the legacy of unresolved transgression and from debts that are continually amassed within the ability to ever repay them, under our ability to live in the kind of community God desires for us. We know that the Lord requires us to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. Jesus' instruction to Peter and his subsequent story gives us a clear sense that forgiveness is in line with what is required of us. It's a crucial part of participating in God's beloved community." Of course, speaking of forgiveness and actually practicing it are complex. Sitting amongst this congregation will be those who have experienced personal hurts from which it is hard to walk away, let alone forgive. And perhaps that's why these two stories sit in contrast to each other. For we long to forgive in an unlimited way, but sometimes we find we have to choose the path of Exodus, the hope of a new creation in a new land of opportunity. And perhaps from that distance, we might weave our own stories of redemption that tell of God in action in our slavery to our past and the hurt we have felt, but the journey we have walked that allows us to speak of love. Amen.